Good morning. On today's programme, the return to Nigeria of some of the most culturally significant artefacts looted from the country in the 19th century, and how Tenerife is benefiting from investment in technology to provide clean water. But first to Australia, and a case that has mystified the country. 2 months ago, two sisters from Saudi Arabia were found dead in their beds in Sydney. The women had sought asylum in Australia, but few details of their private lives have been revealed. Police investigating the crime appear no closer to solving the mystery of their deaths. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
They were like two little sparrows that were scared of something. That's how a building manager described Azra Abdullah Al-Saili and her younger sister Amal. In early June, the sisters from Saudi Arabia were found dead in a flat in Sydney. Their bodies were in separate bedrooms and had laid undiscovered for more than a month. How and why they died remains unclear. They lived in apartment 115 in a modern block in the Canterbury district of Sydney. The rent hadn't been paid for weeks, so the landlord sent in a debt collector. Detectives say there were no signs of forced entry to the apartment and no obvious signs of injury. The deaths are being treated as suspicious and unusual. Media reports have suggested that initial toxicology and post-mortem results were inconclusive. A coroner will try to determine how the sisters, aged 23 and 24, died. The pair moved to Australia as teenagers from Saudi Arabia in 2017 and sought asylum, but we don't know on what grounds. The police have said there's nothing to suggest that their family back in Saudi Arabia should be considered suspects. Both women worked as traffic controllers, a common job for backpackers and new migrants, while they studied at a vocational education school. This is a case with far more questions than answers. Why did they come to Sydney? What or whom were they running from? And why did they die alone? Newspapers have reported that one of the women feared being persecuted because of her sexuality and the other had become an atheist. Both homosexuality and atheism are illegal in Saudi Arabia. Other reports stated that necklaces with Christian crucifixes were found in the women's rooms. Another said they were escaping a forced marriage, had renounced Islam and changed their names. There's also speculation their asylum claims had been rejected and that they'd struggled to pay the rent. Was it that the two little sparrows were afraid of a male relative or had been followed by a private investigator? Saudi expatriates have spoken of the shame some families might feel if their daughters flee. They've also described the desperation of relatives to track them down to try to save face. It appears the sisters kept to themselves, were anxious and fearful of something or someone. In 2018, two sisters who fled Saudi Arabia were found bound together on the banks of the Hudson River in New York. They had drowned. The deaths were classified as suicides, and law enforcement sources said the sisters would rather do harm to themselves than return to their home country. The apartment manager in Sydney did call the police, who came to check on the sisters. They said they were fine and the officers left. A restraining order taken out on a former boyfriend, an Iraqi man, appears to have no connection to the case. 2 months on, despite extensive inquiries, investigators remain baffled over what happened to Azra and Amal. Their flat is back on the rental market. A real estate advertisement has said the sisters' unexplained deaths were not a random crime and will not be a potential risk for the community. The gruesome mystery of apartment 115 continues. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Next, we go to Nigeria, where in the 19th century, British soldiers took hundreds of bronzes, intricate sculptures and plaques dating back to the 13th century onwards, when they invaded the Kingdom of Benin, located in what is now southwestern Nigeria, in 1897. The artefacts ended up in museums around Europe and in the United States. and for years African countries fought to recover them. That fight has started to yield some success now, with some of the looted artefacts being returned. From Abuja, Nigeria, Polum David reports.
Over 100 years ago, while Britain colonized Nigeria, the then Benin Kingdom, now in present-day southern Nigeria, was invaded by British forces and thousands of handcrafted and sculptured artifacts were seized from the King's Palace and taken away to European museums. Those artworks today are referred to as Benin bronzes and are rich with historical, ritual, and religious significance. The exact number of the artifacts looted is still unclear, but historians believe that there are more than 10,000 stolen objects. The Benin bronzes have a huge commercial value. For example, in 2007, an artifact was sold for $4.74 million in New York. Many Nigerians today only saw images of these artifacts in history books, but the narrative is now changing as the present administration of President Muhammadu Buhari is mounting immense pressure on countries and institutions. He is appealing to them to return Nigeria's artifacts in their possession. These talks are beginning to yield fruits as the German government recently signed a restitution agreement transferring ownership of more than 1,100 Benin bronzes to Nigeria. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock said the Benin bronzes are returning home and it was wrong to take the bronzes and wrong to keep them for 120 years. Germany has also pledged to help with the construction of a museum of West African arts to be located in Benin City to safeguard the artifacts. Nigeria has more than 50 national museums, but authorities are looking to set up more. Aside Germany, the British Museum in London houses more than 900 of these items. 213 artifacts are also expected from Britain, and another set of 60 artifacts expected from the USA. Jesus College in the University of Cambridge became the first UK institution to restore a looted Benin bronze to Nigeria. What they returned was a sculpture of a cockerel that once adorned the palace in the former Benin Kingdom. Students at the college raised doubts in 2016 about the morality of the institution's continued possession of the bronze. The college's master, Sunita Allen, concluded that restitution is the right thing to do out of respect for the unique heritage and history of these artifacts. Also, Aberdeen University called the invasion of Benin Kingdom one of the most notorious examples of the pillaging of cultural treasures associated with the 19th century European colonial expansion and announced the planned handover of a stolen sculpture of a king's head back to Nigeria. Similarly, London's Honeyman Museum said it returned 72 artifacts, including 12 brass plates, to the Nigerian government. Chairperson of the museum, Eve Salomon, said the evidence is very clear that these objects were acquired through force, and external consultation supported their view that it is both moral and appropriate to return their ownership to Nigeria. Authorities and citizens are hoping that this return will trigger more museums around the world to do the same. Head of Nigeria's Commission for Museums and Monuments, Abba Tijani, says efforts are ongoing to retrieve more artifacts from Australia, New Zealand, United Kingdom, and other individual museums across the globe. He said agreements have also been reached for the return of the Benin bronzes in the British Museum of Anthropology and Archaeology at the University of Cambridge, United Kingdom, as they hold the second largest collection of such artifacts. Nigerian authorities say after retrieving all these artifacts, citizens will be allowed to have a look at them and reconnect with their history. Analysts say since Nigeria has been looking for ways to diversify its economy, tourism is one way it can go, and these artifacts will help in a great measure. Meanwhile, a young Nigerian, Chidi Nwaobanu, launched a project called Looty to reclaim Africa's stolen artifacts by creating 3D images of them. He plans to sell the images as non-fungible tokens, that is NFTs, and use the proceeds to fund young African artists. Nwaobanu described his project as an alternative form of repatriation by which digital technologies are used to reclaim a measure of control and ownership over artifacts still far away from Africa. For World Reports, this is Paloom David in Abuja, Nigeria.
Finally, we go to Tenerife in Spain, and the island has managed to avoid the devastating droughts which affected some parts of Spain this summer following intense heat waves linked to climate change. Tenerife has for years invested heavily in technology to reuse water and regenerate water use, as Cliona O'Flynn now reports from Tenerife.
Earlier this month, the president of the Tenerife Island government visited the works for a new water plant in Adeje in the southwest of the island. The plant will, when finished, produce up to 25,000 cubic metres of water fit for the irrigation of plants and crops daily. This is water that's coming from the sewage from Adeje and Arona and being cleansed for agricultural purposes. In fact, just this week, the island's agricultural councillor, Javier Parilla, confirmed that Tenerife is able to resist the devastating droughts affecting some parts of the Spanish peninsula due to our systems of regenerating water use. 2 weeks ago, this was a local story, but in recent days, it might be worth having a look at it again internationally. When so many northern European countries are entering or have entered periods of drought, could it be worth looking at how a cluster of islands near to the equator with no overland fresh water sources, so no rivers or lakes, have a constant supply of drinking water and water for irrigation and agricultural use? Water, water everywhere, and all the boards did shrink. Water, water everywhere, nor any drop to drink, bemoaned Samuel Coleridge. And here in the Canary Islands, simply by being islands, we do have water, water everywhere, and actually a lot to drink from the sea. Drinking water here is derived from both underground natural water galleries and, importantly, large desalination plants. There are now two in my borough, one which is working on desalination and remineralization of waters from the sea for human consumption, and the one I mentioned at the start, which will be producing an increased amount of water for farms. The local councils have also created municipal laboratories, so these days, while you can buy bottled water if you want, our borough guarantees that water from domestic taps is 100% fit for cooking and drinking, which is pretty impressive actually. Speaking to press regarding the irrigation plant opening, which is at a cost of 8.7 million euros, the Island Councillor for Sustainable Development, Javier Rodriguez, commented, "This is a fundamental advance in our circular economy, converting waste into a new resource. And on small islands like ours, the idea of a circular economy is becoming increasingly popular, and not just where water is concerned." The insular government president, Pedro Martín, explained that they view this development as part of the plan to improve and amplify the water treatment installations in the island. He said, "Since 2019, we've been treating 100% of the sewage, and now, with the new purification system, the water will be apt for use in agriculture and available for farmers in much of the south, from San Miguel to Santiago del Teide." The local mayor, José Miguel Rodríguez Fraga, said, "The possibility of having access to 25,000 cubic metres of purified desalinated water daily for agricultural purposes is great news." Adeje has a population of about 50,000 and millions of visitors annually to the Costa Adeje resort area. Tourism is so important to the area that the provision of basic services such as running water is an absolute essential. So without adequate natural resources, alternatives have been used for decades. Adeje's main water company is Ente Mancer, and yes, we pay water charges. According to Pedro Gomez, the desalination plant treats 10 million litres of water a day. Our water comes from the above-mentioned underground galleries, which store rainwater and melted snow and ice, gathered from our volcanic Mount Teide when it snows there for a few weeks of the year. So there is a supply of natural water during certain times of the year. However, without the desalination plant, the water supply wouldn't be either enough nor dependable. In my 20-plus years living here, we have never had a shortage of water in homes or pools. And in recent years, the water from these plants is now also 100% safe to drink. The water coming into the plants has salt removed and treated to get rid of algae, bacteria and any parasites, and then minerals are added. Water is pumped to an insular station for further treatment before being deemed fit for distribution among the population. And according to the company, the process involves 85 kilometres of pipes. Overall, the Canary Islands has over 330 desalination plants, primarily located in Gran Canaria, Lanzarote, Tenerife and Fuerteventura. 291 use inverse osmosis, 28 work through electrodialysis, and 7 use a distillation process. and the very first plant was introduced to Lanzarote in 1964, and the numbers grew with the population and economic expansion of the islands. We are still advised, as a rule, about water waste. These days, eco-education is thankfully accepted here as an essential element, but we haven't suffered the kind of shortages in our domestic lives that other countries might be experiencing now. As things are changing globally, climatically, maybe some of our northern neighbours could take a leaf from the Canarian playbook. For World Report, this is Cliann O'Flynn in Tenerife.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. But until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.